today, and I want to welcome, on behalf of the court, for Walworth County High School, with the students from Walworth County High School. Please stand. Thank you, and welcome to you all. Please be seated. And we have with us also the Whitewater Pre-Law Society. You will all stand. Well, we're delighted to have you again. This is an almost annual event for the court to have the society students with us and then have a lunch with them. Please be seated. The Walworth County High School is here with our Court with Class program. This program, which the court runs in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin, has won 2 national awards and is being replicated across the country. These students have received materials about the case we are about to hear, and then the students will meet at lunch with, but no lunch will be provided, lunchtime. With Justice Ann Walsh of Bradley, that is the Walworth County High School students. The Whitewater Pre-Law Society will meet with other justices of the court, and there will be lunch at Costa's, I believe. That's not a paid commercial. All right. The students from the Walworth County High School will be joined by Beaver Dam High School students and Soaring High School students. With that said, I would now like to introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated next to him is Justice John Wilcox. And to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And the empty chair will soon be filled by Justice William Babich. And to the left of the empty chair is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to the far left, Justice David Prosser. With these introductions and preliminary matters taken care of, we'll turn to 97-0536-CR, State v. Orlando Spears. Assistant Attorney General Pamela McGee will argue first for the state of Wisconsin. Ms. McGee.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Pamela McGee. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State Justice Department. I'm here this morning to represent the petitioner, the state of Wisconsin. The state submits that the issue to be addressed by this court is whether the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion when it stated that the victim's arrest record was irrelevant to the sentencing process in this case and refused to give it any weight in mitigation of the defendant's sentence. The state takes the position that the trial court did not erroneously exercise its discretion when it concluded that the murder victim's arrest record was irrelevant to the sentencing proceeding and should not be given any weight. Further, the state asks this court to conclude that the decision of the Court of Appeals, which remanded for a resentencing hearing and directed the trial court to take the arrest record of the victim into consideration in its sentencing decision, should be overruled because the Court of Appeals improperly substituted its discretionary judgment for that of the trial court. The holding in this case should be that the trial court properly exercised its discretion in deciding what information should be given weight in its sentencing decision and what should not. Specifically, it should not be required to consider the victim's arrest record if it decides in its discretion that the arrest record of the victim is not relevant in this particular case. The facts of this case briefly are as follows. The defendant, Yolanda Spears, was partying with friends and became intoxicated. As she left the bar, the murder victim, Philip Young, snatched her purse along with that of one of her companions. A man who was in the vicinity chased Young down and recovered the purses. However, Spears, who is the defendant in this case, then entered her automobile and chased the victim, Young, who was walking on the sidewalk a few blocks away. She knocked him into the street with her vehicle. She then drove around the block, returned to where the victim lay in the street, and ran over him. Young died as a result of the injuries which were inflicted by the actions of Yolanda Spears. Now, Spears was originally charged with first-degree intentional homicide. However, pursuant to a plea agreement, the charge was reduced to second-degree intentional homicide. And the state noted for the record that the charge was reduced as a result of the mitigating circumstances involved in the facts of this case, specifically the fact that Young himself initiated the events which culminated in his death. Spears, who had no previous criminal record and was a single mom working and caring for her daughter, entered the plea. At the sentencing hearing, it was noted that the record before the court contained a sentencing memorandum prepared in Spears' behalf. Attached to that sentencing memorandum was a printout of Young's arrest record. Young, of course, is the murder victim in this case. The prosecutor objected to the fact that Young's arrest record was included as part of that memorandum, but she indicated that she wouldn't object if defense counsel referred to the information contained in the arrest record. The trial court stated that the arrest record would remain attached to the memorandum and would not be deleted or struck in some formal way. And the trial court further indicated that it would listen to what defense counsel had to say about it, but that Young's specific prior arrest record was not relevant to those proceedings. In its written decision on Spears' motion for resentencing, the trial court stated that consideration of Young's arrest record was not necessary because it was not relevant to rebut any other information that was presented at the hearing, nor was it relevant in mitigation of the crime. The trial court said in that memorandum, even should a sentencing court be entitled to consider the murder of a career criminal as less serious, certainly the court has the discretion not to do so. In this case, I chose not to treat the victim's criminal record as a mitigating factor.
Now, mitigation of the crime or mitigation in sentencing, or is that an absurd question in effect because it's one and the same?
Well, I don't think that it's an absurd question, and I think the issue was whether or not, actually it was a two-pronged issue, whether or not it should be accepted in rebuttal of anything that had been presented in behalf of the victims, and secondly, whether it was relevant in terms of mitigating what the court's ultimate sentence might be.
Yep. Now here, as I understand it, the family of the deceased testified and spoke about him being a good person, etc., etc., and this would have been in rebuttal to that to show that he had a lengthy criminal record. The state's position is it should be a discretionary call by the trial judge. But you could imagine, and I'm not sure that I disagree with that, but there obviously would be situations different than this where, say it would be a victim would be a multiple rapist, had a long record, and this was a similar situation. And there, it would seem to me that the judge possibly could abuse his or her discretion by not allowing that, particularly if similar evidence of character came in. Do you agree with that, or do you think that this is something that should never come in?
I think there may be circumstances under which what is known as adverse victim information or negative victim impact statements could be relevant or should be given some weight. One of those circumstances might have been in this particular situation if the victim's, Mr. Young's, family had indicated that he was a model citizen, he'd never been arrested. Those would have been factual matters that the victim's family brought to the court's attention, which would have been inaccurate. And then the arrest record might well have been relevant to rebut particular factual inaccuracies.
Why is it? Obviously, it's relevant to rebut factual inaccuracies, but what difference does it make? Does it matter if the victim was a good boy or a bad boy?
I think
that's the point I thought that the trial court judge was making here, namely, a human life is a human life. And if it's a poor person or a rich person or a physician or a secretary, it shouldn't matter.
That is the concern in mandating that a trial court consider something in particular with respect to negative victim impact information without having any reason, particular reason for it.
Well, if it's so relevant, then why isn't the state taking the position that it shouldn't be allowed, period? If it doesn't matter if the victim is rich or poor, has a conviction for theft, or has an honorary medal as an altar boy, if that doesn't matter, then why shouldn't there be an absolute prohibition?
I think it's difficult to envision all circumstances that may arise in a sentencing proceeding before the trial court. Certainly in this particular proceeding, the circumstances were very unusual. It was the victim that had the arrest record. The defendant, Ms. Spears, had no prior association with the court system. She didn't have any prior record. And these circumstances were very unusual. I think there may be circumstances or situations out there that present themselves that might require some type of consideration of some type of information that's being presented, but we can't know for sure. It has to be looked at on an individual basis, just as any discretionary situation is looked at. And that's the position that the state is taking, that the trial court, in its discretion, should be able to evaluate the factual information that's put before it and determine whether or not a particular piece of negative victim impact information should be considered, taken into account.
How should the court take into account a victim impact statement? That is, the family is obviously grieving, and rightly so, whether the person has always been free of crime or arrest. How should the court consider that in granting, in imposing sentence? So suppose you have somebody who was a homeless person, has no family, no one specific shows up at sentencing, and yet this man, this homeless person, has been killed. A human life has been taken. Now, do you sentence the defendant differently? I mean, let's just take this case, for example. Instead of a victim who had a loving family and who cared and came to testify at sentencing, it was a homeless man who had snatched her purse, and now she runs him over. Would the sentence be any different?
The victim's rights statute allows family members, interested members, to make presentations to the court at sentencing time for whatever reason, for whatever information that might be presented to the court. But courts in Wisconsin have the opportunity to take into consideration a wide variety of information, and they're given the discretion to take into account and give whatever weight they feel is important to that information, as long as they consider the three major factors that have to be considered.
Which are?
Protection of the public.
Gravity of the offense.
Sorry, things just...
Rehabilitative needs of the defendant.
Yes, those three matters. And, of course, there are other...
Well, let's look at them. The gravity of the offense is the same no matter who is killed, isn't it? You've killed a person. Is it worse if you killed a mother and left a child without a mother than if you killed a homeless person?
See, I think that is the problem that we face here.
I know, I understand it. Now, if I understood what you could do with the victim's statement, that is the family statement, then I could say whether it's relevant to have adverse victim statements. But I don't understand how the court is to handle the victim's statement. That's why I'm probing.
Well, in that circumstance, as I mentioned earlier, the trial court receives a great deal of information. And part of the information it may get is that this particular victim was an outstanding member of society. Or it may get the information that, or it may get no information about the characteristics of the individual victim. But as the Supreme Court has indicated, victim impact, the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated, the victim impact information is allowed in order to show unique characteristics of the defendant, of the victim, I'm sorry, and of the impact that this crime may have caused to his or her family members. And it's relatively new. There's not a lot of law on this. There's very little law. It hasn't been addressed very frequently, either by other state courts. And, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court has had difficulty with determining whether or not this is appropriate. It just requires looking at various sets of circumstances over a period of time and seeing how it is going to be used and whether the trial courts are able to appropriately take this information into account and as they do with all the other information, give it whatever weight they feel is appropriate.
Could I ask, did the state of Wisconsin facilitate the witnesses for the victim's family testifying to the character of the witness, the victim? At the sentencing hearing, did the district attorney put on these, I think it was 8 people?
These people, there are processes, as you know, here in the state for victims to be taken, or victims' family members also, to be in contact with various victims' rights personnel throughout the state system. And as particularly how these particular people got there or how they knew about it and so forth, I assume that those processes were taken out and taken care of in that way in this particular case. The court inquired of the prosecutor, is there anybody here who wishes to make a statement? And the prosecutor indicated, yes, there's members of the family here that would like to make a statement.
Okay. Well, now, having just admitted that, didn't the state open the door to the kind of rebuttal information that was offered by the defendant?
I'm not indicating that this particular information, the victim's arrest record, could not have been considered by the trial court. What I'm saying is that the trial court had the discretion to determine whether or not he was going to give any weight to this information.
So you wouldn't have objected then if the judge had taken this into account and said this victim was... I've got to watch my language here. This victim was not a nice person, and therefore it was all right to run over him after driving around the block and leaving tire tracks on his back.
No. What I'm saying is that the trial court should have the discretion to make that determination. Whether or not an objection would be appropriate would address the issue of whether or not the court erroneously exercised its discretion in taking that information into account, just as the issue today is whether he erroneously exercised his discretion by not considering that information. As I mentioned earlier, I think there are circumstances, there could be circumstances, but we're not exactly sure where that bottom level or that top level might be. But in this particular case, I think the trial court properly carried out its obligation to take into consideration the facts of record, the law that's applicable at a sentencing hearing, and approached his decision with a rational decision-making process and reached a reasonable decision, and therefore the Court of Appeals should not have overturned or required a resentencing hearing.
The Court of Appeals decision says that the defendant is entitled, I think, to put in this information as compared to your position that it's discretionary. I understand the Court of Appeals decision. But look, let me put myself in the shoes of a defendant. This is my day. This is my sentencing. It depends on whether I'm going to go to jail for 10, 15, 20 years. The other side puts on glowing reports about the victim. Now, you know, what goes into evidence today doesn't really affect the judge. It doesn't affect the defense attorney. It doesn't affect the prosecutor. It doesn't affect the victim. It affects my life, what I'm going to do for the next 20 years. Doesn't it seem fundamentally fair that I should be able to rebut the testimony at my sentencing hearing? And I should be entitled to rebut that kind of testimony?
I think because of the difficult questions that we're faced with in terms of determining whether a victim's worth should be taken into account, that there needs to be standards that the trial court can follow in making these determinations. Just because the defendant has the opportunity herself to make a presentation, and because she can bring in other people to talk about whether or not, or what a good person she is, does not also mean that she should be able to just put in any type of adverse victim information, just because it may be her day and she may be facing.
Well, it contours them that any time there is a victim witness, a victim impact statement that says the victim is good, they're entitled to put something in rebuttal, but not anything unless it's in rebuttal. I mean, is that one of the contours that's possible here?
The contour that would be possible in the state's view is that the trial court can look at that information and see whether or not there has been anything put in behalf of the victim that specifically needs rebuttal, specifically needs being given some weight in the sentencing decision, specifically needs consideration, and make its determination, make his or her determination on the basis of the exercise of discretion within the bounds of the requirements of a sentencing hearing.
I think it would be very difficult. I can see using, in some cases, perhaps the criminal record, but I think to allow it to be expanded beyond that into areas of where there might even be some questions as to the accuracy, the veracity. One thing you do have with a criminal conviction, it has a finality. It's down on paper. And to allow other things to come in to, quote, rebut a victim impact statement, I would think would be troublesome. Are you indicating that there might be other things other than the criminal record coming in possibly other cases?
I am not thinking of anything
other than a criminal record being used.
Well, that's the item that is in this particular case. But I think if we're not giving the trial court discretion to make a determination in this case, then there's going to be additional items that are going to be brought up that may tend to expand the required matters that a trial court has to take into consideration. And that's a difficult proposition. The point is not to take the focus off the sentencing hearing, which is to determine the moral culpability and the proper punishment for the defendant who has been indeed convicted of a crime. And therefore, for this reason, the state submits that the worth of the victim should not be on trial at the sentencing hearing of the defendant. As I mentioned, the moral culpability and the consequences of the defendant's actions should be the focus, with the trial court enabled to exercise discretion with respect to the relevance of the information offered on that issue and the weight to give it. Therefore, the state respectfully requests that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Could I ask you, if the victim had lived and come into court to testify against the defendant, could the victim's criminal record have been brought in at trial?
Relevance of evidence at a trial and relevance of information at a sentencing hearing, I think, are two different concerns, serving two different objectives. And that issue may well have had to be considered in the light of evidentiary rules at the time that the trial was going on.
I have a question. Footnote 6 of the Court of Appeals decision states a second reason why it believes this could have come in, i.e., it supports Spears' account of what happened.
Yes.
Could you comment on that?
Well, I don't think that there was significant controversy over what happened. The trial court specifically said on several occasions that he was approaching the sentencing hearing with the understanding that some assaultive event occurred which precipitated the ultimate crime which occurred here.
This was an out-court plea.
Beg your pardon?
Wasn't this an out-court plea? A strange one.
It was described, yes. It was described as an Alford plea, yes. So the point being that I think that in the circumstances of this particular case, there was no need to try to make a determination of exactly what happened.
Then as to the Court of Appeals' first ground, which was that it compromised claims about his virtue.
Right.
You dispute that. Is that correct?
I dispute that the arrest record compromised claims about his virtue.
Mm-hmm.
What I dispute is that the trial court's discretionary decision on this matter, which was a reasonable decision, determined that it wasn't relevant in these circumstances and that it was not going to give it any weight. And therefore, this is the reason that the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed.
You want a decision from this court reversing the Court of Appeals, so there's no new sentencing procedure, no new sentence procedure, and you want us to say that whether a trial court considers a victim's arrest and conviction record is within the discretion of the trial court. The trial court exercises discretion here, therefore, no new sentence.
Yes.
Is that the decision you want?
Yes.
Thank you. Assistant State Public Defender Richard Margin, representing Yolanda Spears.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Richard Martin, and I do represent Ms. Spears. This case presents important issues with significant implications both for crime victims and for criminal defendants. However, the issues in the case are narrow. They are whether the defense should be allowed to rebut information and evidence presented to the trial court, which painted a fundamentally false picture of what occurred in this crime, and whether the defense is allowed to adduce true and correct information that impacts on the sentencing decision in this case. The victim's family painted one very stark picture of what happened here, that their gentle, loving, kind, dear departed loved one would never hurt a woman, was on the right, getting his life together, on the right path, that it couldn't have happened the way Ms. Spears said it happened, the way her associate said it happened. And, correspondingly, they painted a very dark picture of my client. They called her barbaric. They called her things that, as Justice Prosser might say, we ought not repeat today in court. But you had a parade of family members trashing the character of someone who's never been in trouble in their life. And I think it's a bit unseemly. We have to keep in mind that there are two victims here, and the first was Yolanda Spears. Yolanda Spears was living her life, going about her business, not intruding on Mr. Young's world at all, not invading his world at all. She walked out of a tavern. She was, the state uses the nice word snatch. She had her, according to her and according to her friends, she was smashed in the face twice, to get for the victim, for the, and I must confess, using the words victim and defendant will get confusing here because I often confuse them, and I, even in the transcript there are confusions. She was the victim of a robbery, a brutal, forceful robbery. And in an ordinary circumstance, if what had happened here after the robbery hadn't happened, no one would raise questions about her and her companion's account about what happened. They would say, this man set upon her and her friends, he took two purses, he hit the victim in the face twice, and he took off. And no one would dare suggest that we shouldn't believe these people. These are crime victims and the friends of a crime victim. And so it's just fun, as Justice Bradley suggested, it's just fundamentally unfair for the victim's family to come in and paint a picture which is fundamentally untrue.
Well, let me play the other side of that coin. As a former trial judge, you know, one of the character witnesses that I kind of roll my eyes at is the mother. God love mothers, you know. But what do you expect the mother to say about her daughter or her son, the defendant, you know? And perhaps that plays a role here. I mean, what if I'm a trial judge sitting at a sentencing, and if I have a mother say, you know, the person that they're describing was good and decent and warm and loving and fun, and I understand that, but I also understand that's the mother. So why do I need to open up Pandora's box? I'm a trial judge. Why do I need to listen to all of the stuff that's going to rebut it? And in reality, I really don't consider that much in sentencing anyway. I mean, you know.
Well, I respectfully submit that it was considered a sentencing, and it played a big part of the sentencing. I mean, there was more time spent by these family members addressing the court than by any of the lawyers in the case, by the defendant. As you said earlier, this is the defendant's sentencing, and yet the bulk of the transcript is taken up with one after another. It's not just a mother's love. This is a love of seven other people, including the mother of Mr. Young's child. And I think this really goes to the heart of what a trial judge has to do with sentencing. I think it's a very difficult task here because the trial judge is both a spokesman for the community and a spokesman to the community. And I think if we're going to honor victims' rights and honor their concerns, we have to take them seriously. We don't just sit and let them say whatever comes into their mind, vent their spleen, have some sort of therapeutic session, and not speak truthfully and fairly to them as a spokesperson of the community. I think it does a disservice, frankly, to these victims, family members, to simply allow them to say the things they said and not challenge them and not say, now wait a second, your loved one set this chain of events in motion. If you don't do that, as Judge Franke did in part, but also didn't in part, what happens is the victims walk out of court unsatisfied, feeling that the system coddled a criminal, let somebody off with a slap on the wrist. And so I think that this is a difficult task for a judge, and that's what judges are paid to do, shoulder these difficult tasks, and weigh the competing interests here. The mother's love thing is very important because the defendant's parents also spoke here. And in contrast to what the victim's family did, there was dignity in what they said. They recognized their daughter had done a serious wrong thing. They said that the victim didn't deserve to die. So I think that this mother's love thing goes only so far, and you still have to take into account what they've said and deal with it. I'm sorry.
Well, the Constitution, 9M says that the state shall ensure that the victim have the following privileges and protections, and one of them is the opportunity to make a statement to the court at disposition. So I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Ms. McGee, namely, what should the trial court do with the victim's statement that they're grieving over the loss of a dear one? That there's a tremendous impact on the family. I mean, whether the guy is a good guy or a bad guy, there's a tremendous impact on the family. They loved him. How should the trial court consider that information when it's deciding whether to give your client 20 years, 15 years, 10 years, or no years?
Well, I think it has to consider it in several respects, but the most important is to say very clearly, as I said, as the voice of the community, this conduct shall be punished. It must be punished. It's blameworthy conduct.
Yeah, well, she killed a man, so it's going to be punished. Does it matter whether that man is 29 and at the height of a career? and left three children? Or does it matter that the man is homeless and has no one grieving for them and is going to be buried in whatever is the present equivalent of the pauper's cemetery?
Sure.
Does it matter? Is it your position it matters?
It matters to a very limited extent. I don't think that anyone on the defense side in this case at trial and certainly on appeal has suggested that this victim deserved to die, that he got what he had coming. But it does diminish the facts of this case and this victim's conduct in bringing it about, and his criminal record, which is demonstrated that conduct, set in motion the chain of events. This is a lesser tragedy than if a purely innocent person was crossing the street to give a presentation on scientific research and was hit by Ms. Spears.
Yeah, but his past record doesn't have anything to do with it. This could be his first offense. Right?
I think that this past record is emblematic of his conduct. The brazenness of this attack, attacking two people in the presence of two others, four people together in a semi-public place, this does not have the earmarks of a first offense. A first offender who's going to snatch a purse, going to find a dark street, a solitary woman, run up behind him, grab it, and take off. This is a brazen, violent, assaultive person, so it does matter.
And that's what you wanted to show by the history.
I'm sorry?
That's what the history is, criminal record, what it's shown is prior assaultive behavior.
Right, it corroborates, and this is what Judge Schutzen said in the footnote 6, and we'll talk about this in a minute, it corroborates Ms. Young's account of this crime. And Judge Franke tried to get to the heart of this, but he never resolved whether this was a physical assault with actual violence or merely the threat of violence. If the defendant had lived and he'd been charged with robbery...
You mean if the victim had lived?
I told you I'd get confused. If the victim had lived and he'd been charged with robbery, and his defense was no, it was only theft from person, there was no robbery, no force, no threat of force, there is no doubt that the state would seek to admit the robbery that he just got out of prison for as probative of his intent to use force and violence, because he'd done the same thing. He'd attacked a woman at a gas station, again a semi-public place, in the presence of her daughter, reaching into her car, using force, leaving her injured as he left Ms. Spears injured, and the state would clearly have sought to adduce that. And similarly, the state, at a sentencing for Mr. Young, would have recited that. I think it's important to understand, and I don't know if the briefs are as clear as they could be, about whether there were any meaningful disputes in sentencing here.
Counsel, and, before you get to that, what's the legislative intent under 972.14, number one, and number two, how does allowing negative victim testimony enhance that intent?
You'll tell me what 972.14 is, or...
I thought that's... I'm sorry. 972.14 sub 3, before pronouncing sentence, the court shall also allow a victim or family member of a homicide victim to make a statement, or submit the victim statement.
Sure.
So what's the legislative intent behind the statute that's before us, and how does your position enhance or is consistent with that legislative intent?
I think the legislative intent is to provide a full airing of the facts of the case before the court, so that
where do you get? I mean, I know that's what you would like to argue. I'm talking about a specific statute, 972.14 sub 3, which reads as follows: before pronouncing sentence, the court shall also allow a victim or family member of a homicide victim to make a statement or submit a written statement to be read in court. The court may allow any other person to make or submit a statement under this paragraph. Any statement under this paragraph must be relevant to sentence. What's the intent behind sub 3?
I think the intent is twofold, and I'm not basing this on an analysis of the precise language, but on the history that we've all lived through. There has been a perception in the public that the focus of the criminal justice system has been too much on defendants and defendants' rights, criminals' rights, however you want to put it, and that victims have been left at the side. They've not been honored. They've not been heard. Their wishes haven't been considered. And this is a legislative attempt, and then now a constitutional amendment, to make sure that those concerns are brought before the court, that the court hears, in a sense, both sides. The court hears the public's concern, as exemplified by the victims of the crime before the court. And I think that to give that full impact, it requires the court to not just listen, but take seriously these victims' concerns. I think that's the sort of two-edged sword here, and that's why Some of the cases the state cites from other jurisdictions have rejected this victim impact statement because once you open Pandora's box, and Ms. Spears didn't open this box, the legislature opened it with this legislation, and the state opened it by adducing this information for sentencing. Once you open it, there's no principled way to say, but you've got to have one hand tied behind your back, and you can't say they're wrong, they're not giving the full picture, they're not telling you the whole truth. It's just not, there's no principled way to say that. So some courts, and the cases are cited in the briefs, have said, we're not going to even go down that road at all. And we'd be in a different situation if this state had said we're not going down that road at all.
Do you concede that your position of proffering negative victim testimony is inconsistent with the intent of that statute?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I think that my position goes to a constitutional right for to be sentenced on the basis of true and correct information. And I think that a trial court has a significant responsibility, perhaps, to circumscribe victims' presentations if they go too far afield. I mean, you see that in this case. There were situations, one victim, family member, attempted to address the defendant personally, and the judge said, no, you addressed me. After six of them had spoken, the judge suggested perhaps we could shorten this up. There were times when the defense was making its presentation, the victims exclaimed liar and similar type things, and the court was not going to countenance that. It's one thing to say we're going to allow victims to be heard, but just like anyone else who comes before a court, there have to be reasonable limits. There have to be, what is said has got to have some relevance to the sentencing.
Mr. Martin, wasn't the sentencing hearing in this case on November 14th, 1995?
Yes, sir.
And wasn't the sentencing memorandum that contained all the derogatory evidence about the victim filed on November 9th, 1995. Isn't it a little hard for you to argue that all this stuff is a rebuttal to the testimony of the witnesses about the victim?
Well, without pulling out all the letters and looking to see whether they're all file stamped, I don't think so, Justice Prosser, because this is a case received a lot of publicity in Milwaukee. It's very clearly an unusual case in many respects. And the victim's family members were writing letters to the court well in advance of sentencing and painting, and this is quoted in the briefs, some of the same picture of Mr. Young that they painted orally. And whether this was in the sentencing memorandum, it's hard to know what use would have been made of it if the trial court had to shut down the defense and said it's not relevant. Because what happened here is they come into court, and the prosecutor very early on says, I have an objection to the inclusion of this material. I've never seen this done before. It's not relevant. His record is not relevant.
Why shouldn't I have the belief that this sentencing memorandum is almost a diabolical attempt to destroy the victim impact process in the sentencing hearing? Because, I mean, once you open this door, All the people who come forward to talk about the victim have to know they're opening up the door to rebuttal, if you prevail.
Well, I obviously would take exception to the word diabolical. I think it's an attempt to get the truth out, to get the truth on the table. And I think that it is right and fair that persons should not be allowed to address the court with impunity, with no fear of contradiction. It goes to the basics of due process, notice and right to be heard. And if these victims' family members are going to address the court ad infinitum and untruthfully, it cannot be right that they should be allowed to do so unrebutted, unrefuted, unchallenged, and simply be able to allowed to do it. And so, I mean, I think that it, at some point a court or even a prosecutor may suggest to the victim's family that you may want to consider the impact of what you're saying, because if you say this, the defendant is going to say, well, that's just not true. I don't say, and I think I make this point fairly clearly in the brief, I don't say that a defendant has license to bash victims and engage in character assassination of victims and challenge their character unless there's some nexus between what the victim did to bring about the crime. And you've got that nexus here, a very clear nexus, a life of crime, 18 arrests in 11 years of adult life, one for the very same thing just, and a conviction just months before. And we talk about, are we evaluating Mr. Young's...
Sorry. If in fact, Mr. Young's family had said nothing, the victim's family had said nothing, would Ms. Spears still have the availability speak to her of his crime record?
I think to a much more limited extent, only as it bore on what footnote 6 talks about, the account of what happened that day. I think the defense would have a right to, because Judge Frankie was very concerned here about what happened. I started to get into that before. He asked on page 31, who initiated the beating of the victim, Mr. Young? On page 33, he wanted to know how far that beating was from the scene of the crime. He said, I would like to achieve as best an understanding as I can of what caused this to happen. Then he said on page 33, other than the defendant's partisans, was there any proof, any independent proof, that the victim even assaulted Ms. Spears? On 34, he asked, was there any objective evidence? Was there a broken nose? On page 53, he says, I didn't realize until just a few days ago that there were some considerable factual disputes here. On 54, he says, there's some question about the degree of provocation. I know I shouldn't read much, but I just want to quote from what one thing he said about that, because it is really crucial to this dispute thing. He says, there appears to be some question about the degree of provocation, but I'm satisfied that the victim in this case engaged in an assaultive offense against you and your friends. I'm satisfied that he set about, with whatever intent or particular motives he had, to snatch your purse, and that this was done with some violence, or at least some threat of violence. And he continues to say, he talks about, you were subject to an assault either by violence or the threat of violence. And he just continually refuses to and feels that he cannot resolve that. There's a case which is not cited in the briefs. The advance sheet was printed after my brief was done, State versus Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, at 222 with second 403. It's a court of appeals decision, although the facts are quite different. The issue there were unresolved disputes, and the court of appeals said a trial court has to resolve things that impact on sentencing that are unresolved. You can't just leave them hanging. And I think here, the ironic thing is Judge Frankie recognized that he had to resolve this. He wanted to resolve it. He was reaching out for help to resolve it, and yet at the same time ignoring the one document which would go a long way to resolving it.
There was a motion to strike this document, and as I understand it, he denied the motion. Let's say none of the victim's relatives testified or made any statements at the sentencing hearing. Should the motion to strike then have been granted?
I don't think so. I think that a defendant's right of allocution has to be considered here, and a defendant's right to rebut even the statements of the victims in the letters, even the question that arises without their statements. And so, to the limited extent of what footnote 6 talks about, the information should have been before the court to consider. I agree that how much weight to give it is certainly always a question for the trial court. But it's just, you know, there's a certain irony here. If we didn't know any things about Mr. Young that we know, none of us would necessarily assume that there was a purse snatching. There are four people here on the street saying there was a purse snatching, but how do we know that? Well, one of the reasons we know it is he's been doing things like this whole life.
Justice Prosser raises an interesting point when he notes that the sentencing was on November 14th, but this information concerning the prior record was filed with the court 5 days before that, on November 9th. How can you assert that it is submitted to the court in rebuttal of what's said at sentencing when it was submitted 5 days before sentencing?
Well, it was submitted, you're correct, before sentencing, but I think that it was the issue here was joined well before sentencing. The pretrial discussions, the plea itself, the pre-sentence report, Ms. Spears professed amnesia about what occurred. There were victims' defendants' friends who testified or gave statements indicating that she had been assaulted. And any defense attorney who's conscientious, who's preparing for this, who knows that the victim's family is writing letters, who knows that it is more relatively certain that one or more of them will appear, and who knows that the person who's died has this criminal record, I think would be derelict to not have that fund of information available. What use it may be made of it is certainly for the court to decide at sentencing, but the information itself, I think it was very wise to have it available. Otherwise, you'd be left with the defense attorney saying, well, Judge, you know, he's done this before. Well, how do you know that? Well, I've heard it.
Suppose Mr. Young had been a communist.
I'm sorry?
Suppose Mr. Young had been a communist. That doesn't mean quite as much today as...
Well, a real bad communist.
A bad communist.
Oh, I'd forgotten.
Think of something. Not criminal, but could the defense have brought that fact up?
Well, was he planting a bomb at a military research facility and he got killed by a good person who was trying to protect their country? Yes, it would be relevant. In the abstract, that he held unpopular political views? No. If there's a nexus between the person's, and there's case law, and this is pretty far afield, JED and other cases, it's a violation of the First Amendment to punish someone for their political views. But if there's a connection between an expression of First Amendment rights and a violent act, it is proper to consider that. That's what hate crimes laws are about. That's what some of the Aryan Brotherhood case from the U.S. Supreme Court is about.
Can you ignore the rape shield law during a sentencing hearing?
Well, the statute 9/11, I don't have the... got it here somewhere. It's in chapter 9/11. Specifically says the rules of evidence do not apply at sentencing. And so, to the extent that that's an evidentiary rule, could be argued that you could. I'm not sure how it would come up. I mean, it would depend on the circumstances of the case.
So that possibly a victim of a rape's sexual history could be brought out by defense counsel at a sentencing hearing.
I'm sorry, the victim.
The victim of a rape, of
right.
a sexual assault.
Right.
That victim's sexual history could conceivably be brought out.
Are you talking about the victim bringing up their own sexual history? I mean, you...
No, I don't know, defense counsel.
She's a prostitute, so, you know, the rape isn't as serious than if she were not. No. I mean, that, we might disagree with that, but that's his position.
I see. I don't think that you want to argue or want to posit a situation where, let me back up, a prostitute has a right not to be raped, period. A prostitute has a right to not give consent, period. And so the fact that someone may choose to, on other occasions, prostitute themselves does not take away from them the right to not be raped. And so I don't think that would be relevant.
Well, a purse snatcher doesn't get a death penalty in this state either.
Correct. And nor does
nor
someone...
It's a third offender or a 19th offender, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So what's relevant about his being a multiple offender? Just like a prostitute has no right to be raped, or has a right not to be raped, I should say.
Well, I think the difficulty is we're all uncomfortable, and I have never suggested that Mr. Young deserved to die, had it coming, or anything like that. But having, and the defense attorney at sentencing made the same point. But having said that, it's still fair to observe that by his lifestyle and by the choices he made, he placed less value in his own life. He placed less value in his own liberty. He committed offense after offense, year after year, subjecting himself to arrest, prosecution, chasing by, he's got a fleeing conviction, he's been chased by the police, he's willing to flee the police and risk his life that way. He himself has shown us by his actions that his life is less valuable than he should properly consider it.
He's 29. He had an opportunity to rehabilitate.
Sure. I'm not saying he deserved to die.
How can you make the argument that his life is less valuable?
I didn't. I said he placed, by what he did, he showed that he placed less value on it. He engaged in an inherently risky line of work.
No, the risk was not that he's going to be run over twice by the woman whose purse he snatched.
Well, this court in Oyman or one of the felony murder cases says that when you engage in violent conduct, one of the foreseeable consequences is you yourself may be the victim of violent conduct. There's a case where this court upheld a felony murder conviction where one of the Confederates was killed by the victim. And so when you go in to rob someone, you know they may shoot back.
No, but you don't expect him to run over the guy with a car.
I'm sorry?
You don't expect to be run over by a car twice, deliberately and intentionally, after the act is completed.
I hope not. I mean, I hope you don't expect that.
It seems to me your argument goes in two ways. One way is, was there a purse snatching so that you can understand her horror, you can understand her anger. that, and if you're bringing in other character evidence to show that there was a purse snatching here, that's one thing. And therefore, you might say that mitigates. You know, if you run over somebody who didn't do anything to you, I'd give them more than I would give to somebody who snatched my purse and hit me. Both are bad acts, but you could, I would be mitigated. You'd understand my anger. Okay. And that's footnote 6, it seems to me. But the other, more the pure issue, and forget about footnote 6, we got a guilty plea here, in effect. Guilty plea does not, and according to guilty plea, the victim here that was dead didn't snatch the purse. Assuming that you snatched, the purse was snatched, the question really then is a pure one. Why bring up the victim here, the murdered man? Why bring up his past record? How is that relevant in sentencing her? Why would it make any difference if he's a first-time purse snatcher or 10th-time criminal offender?
Well, I just think that gives insufficient attention to what the victims have done here with this parade of character praise of their dear departed loved one.
I read it, and it's long, so I may have missed it. They called him a good guy, and he was very helpful to them. I don't remember them saying that he was absolutely free from any bad record. In fact, one of them said he had difficulties. They weren't spelled out.
That's true, but they also repeatedly said it didn't happen the way she said. I can't imagine it happened the way she said.
That goes to footnote 6.
It had to be a woman. It's ironic, it's a woman who took him from us. Like, he would never hurt a woman. I mean, this is almost laughable that people can come into court and say you've never hurt a woman when he's been out of prison just a few months for having hurt a woman. He's dead because he engaged in a course of conduct which involved hurting a woman or two women. And it's inconceivable he can't rebut that.
Can a sentencing court take into account the positive aspects of a victim's life in passing sentence?
I thought about that a lot. The reality is sentencing courts do it every day. Sentencing court, I mean, this is a really difficult issue. It's kind of like you can't punish someone for going to trial, but you can give them a break for pleading. There are two sides to this. Sentencing courts repeatedly talk about he was a good provider, he did this, she did that. And the courts do that. And I think, and this is what Judge Schrenke really keyed in on in my motion and was irritated by, was the sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander argument that I made. That if we're going to do this repeatedly in court, if we're going to tell victims you can come in and talk about what a great person he was or she was, then it's only fair when that's not true and when that victim's conduct played a substantial role in the sense of how you define cause and causation cases, it was a substantial factor in his own death.
Well, do you have any law to support the statement that a sentencing court can take into account the positive aspects of the victim's life?
Well, that's what the victim impact cases, in a sense, say, and that's why some states have said we're not going to allow it in, because once we allow it in, we open this door, we open Pandora's box.
That's not going to allow what in?
The positive victim. Some of the states around the country that are cited in the state's brief and dealt with in mine, some states around the country said we're not going to allow this in, because the only reason you can allow in victim worth evidence is to engage in comparative judgments about victim worth. There's no point in hearing that this person was on the road to curing cancer or had provided, started an orphanage or whatever. There's no point in telling that unless it's going to be considered sentencing. And that's the dilemma here. This every day around Wisconsin in sentencing, judges hear routinely about the good things that a victim did.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you.
Ms. McGee, you have a few moments in rebuttal.